Okay, Bob and Cameron are back. Bob Dobbs and Cameron McEwen with number 29, episode 29. And we've went to the very end of this small book and went over line by line the interview with the tech body, which is my conclusion in the book. And the title is How President... Oh, no, no, that's the first title. I did my first statement on Trump was in the spring of 2017 after he was elected and was in the White House. I called that How President Don Trump Has Become the First Executive Political Leader to Put on the Shamanic Tradition. And then I felt the need to update my stuff, so I did a second. This book is the second part, but it includes the first essay.
Can I let me ask about the phrase put on there, which is a technical phrase of McLuhan's. Was your point that he put that on intentionally or unconsciously?
Hard to tell. I would say unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
But he's such a unique figure. It had a shamanic effect on a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
You know, they thought he was so honest and being real and these kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. It's a very interesting image, in my view, because if you think of some sort of tribe somewhere that has a shaman, then of course that shaman's reputation within the group wouldn't depend upon his or her morality or how they dressed or what kind of parents they had or something like that. It would have to do with their power,
right?
That was acknowledged by some or all of the group. And that's an interesting way to look at the Trump phenomenon in my view.
Yeah, and I meant it. It's partly a put-on with me. I know in the media that's a ridiculous statement. I mean, the lamestream media, this guy's a dumb jerk, you know. How could he be a shaman if they even knew
Correct.
What the shaman was? And if they were Gutenberg people, they wouldn't even respect shamans. So they might think that I'm putting down Trump. So in the mainstream people, they would be confused by it. But those that study the shaman tradition, and the whole New Age world is into it in different ways, they wouldn't think Trump's a shaman. He's an asshole, and based on their bias. So I put it on to get an effect on them. It's only an elite like yourself, and properly schooled in the correct areas, say what you said. You know, you said, good statement, Bob. That's interesting. You know what I mean? It fits in a way. So my second essay, longer essay, was what we/you didn't know about Trump. And I'm saying what you didn't know about Trump, the audience. I know what I know about Trump, but I was being polite, so I included myself. And maybe I didn't know about the tech body as I am presented it in 2016. He didn't present it till 2018, 2019. So I didn't know Trump was doing the tech body in 2016. So in that, in relation to the tech body, I didn't know as much as anybody else.
So when you say doing the tech body, the word doing, is that the same as putting on shaman persona, or is doing different from putting on?
Yeah, he does. Trump has no clue about the tech body. He doesn't know the tech body is dominating him, or he's controlled. His image is controlled by the tech body.
Right.
He doesn't know that.
If we think of a shaman, oftentimes. They would visit another world or speak with the dead or something like this. But oftentimes they wouldn't know themselves what they were doing.
Yeah.
They would be in some kind of trance They would be in some sort of auto mode, and then when they came out of that, they might be asked questions about, you know, what were you doing or what did you mean or something like that, and the shaman wouldn't know what the hell they were talking about.
That's right.
Right? Because,
yeah.
Because there's multiple personalities that are involved in the shamanic mode.
Right. Now, some of the more accomplished shamans knew what they were doing, but who knows? I'm not a judge of it. I haven't met many of these really conscious shamans, but I've met unconscious, which are mediums, like JW.
Yeah.
And they can heal people. They do all kinds of things when they're in trance. So, I mean, I've even seen ghosts in JW's home that a session with Ion evokes. Very odd-looking ghosts, strange contraptions. They look like a dadaist structure, and they're there. You can see them, and then the little dog comes in and starts barking at it. So I've had interesting experiences around JW and Ion. So the tech body, I think, is a completely new phenomenon for humans. This is a, you know, a mind stumper or mind blower. People have no idea what's really going on. But I think McLuhan and Ion agrees, and maybe even the tech body, that McLuhan intuited this was coming. The old way I used to say it, talking about the Andor meme, was that technology came alive and took on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
That's a plebeian or cliche, lowbrow way to talk about it.
But I think it's still a very effective description of what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm trying to, I'm available to talk to any level of sophistication about it. And not targeting mm-hmm. academics, not targeting the CIA, and not targeting stupid people or uninformed people. Who's ever interested, I'm willing to take the time to explain it. And this, eventually I wrote this to explain it for people who could mm-hmm. take the time to read it. In that sense, it's a humble project, but I'm hardly humble myself, so to speak, right?
Yes, sir.
So the second title, which was created in the fall of 2020, so 3.5 years later, what we/you didn't know about Trump. So those are the two parts. So we begin, and I want to, it is targeted towards McLuhanites, and I want to inform people about McLuhan that they have no idea, no matter how much they read about McLuhan, that he anticipated the tech body or this weird phenomenon. So I mm-hmm. think I've made a breakthrough on translating McLuhan, right? And I think it's worth people exploring it. And I think I'm qualified to do that. That's my
right.
agenda. Hey, you know, you hear from all kinds of different levels of McLuhanites. But it was about time Bob, the archivist of McLuhan, judged what was going on. So I tried to make a honest, sincere, accurate, and correcting, and mind-blowing statement. That was my goal.
Right.
And
right.
So
let me just emphasize how difficult that goal is.
Yes.
You spoke of the attempt to translate McLuhan. And I don't think that's that the task is radically different from trying to translate Plato or trying to translate Aristotle. And there's lots of other people that knew things that are very, very difficult to understand. And they're difficult to understand because there's no direct route to seeing what they're talking about. It's a little bit like learning another language or being in a different environment where you have to make a kind of jump. And Plato called that jump dialectic after Plato becomes misunderstood as some sort of intellectual thing.
Right.
But for Plato, dialectic is something that can happen between minds. In fact, it happens in all communication. But people do not understand what is going on when they communicate. And so the recurrent attempt to translate is something that's kind of like a motor of the tradition, but it's a motor that's not understood. It's in the background. And what that motor is doing is also not understood. And your attempt to translate McLuhan takes place against that background, very difficult background of trying to show people what everybody knows, but nobody knows.
Yeah, right. And I'm fully aware of that. I know the task. Mm-hmm. And Alex Kusk has told me that somebody wrote to him after this came out, got put on the New Aspiration site, said, "What? How is he equating Trump and McLuhan? How can he even talk about him in the same breath? Like, what is he doing?" And Alex told me, he said back to the guy, "I don't know what Bob's doing." And I was shocked and disgusted with that response. Come on, Alex. First of all, I'm not saying Trump is equal to McLuhan, for freak's sake. You know? It's not what the story is about. I'm using McLuhan to explain Trump. And this guy, whoever he was suggesting you can't discuss McLuhan near Trump. Trump's so disgusting, such a good shaman, that you can't put McLuhan into the same world. So I was amazed.
I am a little bit surprised at Alex's response.
Yeah.
That he didn't know what was going on, because usually the understanding of McLuhan, or the understanding of talk about McLuhan, is blocked by what people do understand or think they understand. So the beginning of understanding is always to know that you don't understand.
Right.
So I liked what Alex said there, that he didn't know what the hell you were talking about.
And he should have corrected the guy at least and say, "I'm not equating Trump and McLuhan." And discuss.
Well, it all depends on what you mean by equating. In one sense, you are.
Yes, but what is it? I'm not. I got the sense, unless Alex badly translated the guy, that there's no way you discuss Trump and McLuhan. You don't put McLuhan in the same disgusting New York ghetto Trump is from.
Right. Well, the other guy, didn't know how to think. I mean, that's somebody that never reads poetry or never talks to somebody who's interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not interested in the other guy. I'm only interested in what Alex had to say, because to me, that's the idea of not knowing what the hell you're talking about. That's good. That's a good place to start.
But he didn't know that.
Well, maybe.
No, he, and, So I said, "Alex, screw you. You're an idiot to give that kind of simple, non-cooperative, not even trying to attempt to explain what I am doing a little bit." And that's why I got kicked off the list. You know, I insulted him, he said. So that's the end of that list. And they don't get any more McLuhan letters that I was posting.
So, I thought you got back onto that list after a while.
No, I was on years ago, three or four years ago, and got kicked off because I was posting too much. It was some ridiculous reason. Posting too much. I was putting out all kinds of good McLuhan stuff for new people that were coming there and wanted to learn about McLuhan. The archive is laying out. And then... So I went to the Ottawa Archives in the summer of 2017 after I got this gift. And so that means I was kicked off in late 2016, early 2017. So then when Alex found out that I had all these letters, he invited me back on. And I did okay for a year or so until this incident came up with this response. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Come on, Alex." And He got mad. So that left me with...
So you were kicked off a second time.
Second time. Yeah, twice. And so, but Fake Explorations, I liked that place because I could talk about Ion. I was not allowed to talk about Ion on the McLuhan list, on Alice's list. No mention of that, Bob. Even though McLuhan went to the Evergreens himself, for Frank's sake, and went to Medium. So it's part of the phenomenon of McLuhan. So I prefer Fake Explorations. That's created by Adam Pugin, a young assistant teacher at the University of Toronto, who has created an environment that lets me put anything up there pretty well. So that's good. Because I'm interested in translating Ion through McLuhan or McLuhan through Ion. And I discuss McLuhan all the time with Ion. Ion makes incredible, accurate, interesting statements about the McLuhan phenomenon and other absurd levels too. But to me, Ion is an update of the style of McLuhan, the way Ion interacts with the callers in the audience. There's, in that sense, the full shamanic meaning, Ion's a shaman, and so was McLuhan. Matter of fact, Robert Fulford called McLuhan an Eskimo. Did you ever see that article? 1967?
I think I did. It rings a vague bell, but I can't remember.
I thought it was really good. It's a good label for McLuhan back in 67. You know, McLuhan was not limited to his culture, and he also had a great, at least imaginary intuition that he understood the primitive culture because of Carpenter's information. So
correct.
Compared to most, just talking from an awareness of the Eskimo, now Inuit, reality, culture, makes you different from the fellow Canadian. So Fulford did well there. McLuhan is an Eskimo.
Right. But Fulford had zero understanding of...
I know, but he could write... I read his column when I lived in Toronto, 77 to 93. Read his column every week. I think it was in the Toronto Star back then. I enjoyed his simple translation of a sophisticated mind, a guy who was aware of a lot of levels, you know. He's quite encyclopedic in a bland, bourgeois, middle-class way. So I enjoyed what he pointed out, what he would discover. And he'd occasionally write about McLuhan. You ever read his book, Best Seat in the House?
No.
Yeah, interesting. He decided that he had the best seat in Canadian culture because he was in grade school with Glenn Gould. He knew McLuhan. He knew a lot of many other people in the art world of Toronto and across the country. So I was always interested in Fulford's commentary in whatever.
Right. But
even
just think what I think of is a guy goes to school with Glenn Gould, knows artists, and interviews McLuhan and all this sort of stuff, and then he dies, and then on his tombstone, he's got, here lies Robert Fulford. He had the best seat in the house. It's ridiculous, right? What a way to lead a life, right? Jesus Christ.
But that's it's Toronto snobbery. It's
it's ludicrous.
And he had his own cult. Many young people, just out of college, trying to get into the humanities or the arts and magazine culture, they went to Fulford. He ran his own scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm sure. It's a, yeah.
But he was he was a mediocre cult leader, you know?
Oh,
you see him,
a leader of a mediocre cult, I would say.
Yes, yeah.
He might have been a superlative leader of a
mediocre cult.
Cult. Yeah.
Okay, so he in a way he competed with McLuhan.
He tried to.
Yeah,
it's absurd. McLuhan just talked to him like he was talking to somebody from Mars or something.
A bad student. A bad student of Northrop Frye.
Yeah.
And that's what Fulford was. He was a bad student of Northrop Frye.
Yeah.
Okay, so I start off laying out the thing around 2017. where I poked it at people. I said, look at this, two schools of art thought that McLuhan talked about, and Trump is one of them. If you take the cathartic ethical approach, you're not going to be able to understand Trump. But if you take the cognitive school, look at the perceptual level of Trump and the figure ground, then you might get somewheres. So that, I just rubbed this obscure McLuhan quote, you know, into this pop culture phenomenon that was disgusting so many people. So that's...
Speak a little bit more about these two schools, because I don't entirely understand what you're saying, but it seems like it's necessary to understand it in order to understand the brochure.
Oh, yeah. The okay, I'm scrolling down to find where that begins. Slowly scrolling down because you can't scoop it down. It goes past it. You have that problem on your computer?
The reason for that, I think, is that you're set to a certain kind of scrolling that jumps between pages instead of
Well,
I think
this,
you can reset that, but I don't know what kind of computer you got and what the settings are.
I'll get my computer repairman.
But we'll come to it. I mean, if it's hard to find, don't worry about it. We'll come to it.
Yeah, no, I've got.
And then you can address it then.
No, we come. I have it now. It just took a while to scroll down.
Okay, good.
But when my computer repairman comes over, I'll get him to check that. It doesn't jump page to page, but it's just slow. And if I pull down on the little square on the right column, it just goes too far. It's hard to make it go short. Okay, so I start off saying, no previous president of the – this is in the spring of 2017 – no previous president of the USA has ever used the office of the White House to provide a training in perception. I'm kind of laughing as I'm doing this, right? It's obvious McLuhan talk.
What page are you on, Bob?
What?
What page? What page?
Page
here we are.
Four.
Page four.
Yeah.
I see it. Yeah.
No previous
president. So we're
going to. Let me just read it. Go into it this way for a minute. No previous president of the USA has ever used the office of the White House to provide a training in perception. Now, McLuhan does a good job explaining how each president's image resonates with the technological ground of the day, you know, say through most of the 20th century. So the president actually expresses the ground more than other people in some way, and so is a training of perception of the larger ground if you know how to look at it. So it's not accurate for me to say that no other guy provided training perception. But I'm implying that Trump was a little more conscious of the game. The White House was so obsolete that he had an extra bravado and indifference to the role. You know what I mean? He was going to hijack it, basically, for business purposes or something. So
yeah, hijacking is a good image there, not only because it's a favorite image of McLuhan in the 70s, but also in the sense that what you're saying is that every president, in order to be the president, has to have a special relationship to the contemporary society, more or less as its representative.
Is it right? That's right.
And in order to understand the series of presidents in the way that you want to understand them, you have to see them as these kinds of representatives. And what I think you're saying of Trump is that with Trump, his representation comes to consciousness in a new way, and that new way is shocking. Some people, it's shockingly bad, and for some people, it's shockingly good.
Yes, and it's a product of the new world, I call it Web 2.0, social media world, that people aren't thinking clearly about or perceptively. And so they got the shock of somebody reflecting the present that they didn't know was happening around them in social media. So when I look back at the presidency since FDR, or maybe even the 20s, Calvin Coolidge, every guy that was a president is appropriate. It was correct that that guy won. He was appropriate. His competitor was not in some way. I mean, just take Reagan versus Mondale. Mondale is nowhere qualified like Reagan is, unconsciously, to be president at that phase of cable TV, Star Wars, global theater and extreme, and in my terms, the beginning of the Android meme. Mondale doesn't make it. He deserved to lose. The president is actually auditioning. They're presenting their image. How does this work? Look at the way I am. Look at the way I come across. You know? Is that?
Yeah. So you're saying that the president can be understood as auditioning for a theater.
For a very important and central point in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the presidents have to be understood as a put-on of a certain role. And in order to put on that role, maybe you have to have, a certain body shape or a certain way of talking or something. But it's a notion of the world as a theater in which everybody is putting on one or more roles, and the president's role is a kind of starring role that needs to express what the particular play is all about.
That's right. And what was I going to say about Reagan? McLuhan in 76 or so in People magazine, he predicted that Reagan was the best guy to become the next president because he had merged with his role. You know, he used some of his favorite phrases. He was a man who merged with his role, and the presidential White House was becoming more of a Baudrillardian simulation or something. And so Reagan matched that. And that was shocking when McLuhan read, when people read McLuhan in the 70s, say, what, Reagan? Come on, that guy's a dummy. And I never respected Reagan as a mind or as a guy who should be president. But the great outpouring by the Android meme and the fake people or somebody, the global audience, for when he died and they put him in latent state for a week. Remember that?
Yeah.
I understood why he got that status, even though I personally didn't think he, quote, deserved it as a person or as a corrupt guy that he'd been in California. I have a very obscure book by Larry Flint, where he goes into the forget the author. Larry Flint sponsored it. He was an Kennedy assassination researcher, friend of Mae Brussel, Don somebody. And he had a lot of dirt on Reagan the human being as governor. Incredible stuff. And
if you think of Reagan and Mondale contrasted, Reagan had more bodies.
Yep.
Right? He had a TV body. He had sort of a Star Wars body from his roles in movies.
Yeah.
Of course, he had his chemical body. So
you know how he had his astral body? His wife had an astrologer in the White House.
Yeah, I remember there was stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But that's if you think of Mondale was a down-to-earth labor union sort of guy, and so the thinking about presidents in terms of the number of bodies and how the bodies related, I think, is interesting.
Yeah, it works. If you need a model, as McLuhan said, people need concepts to get a sense of balance in the reality, even though he was not about concepts. But he knew that his perceptions in book form would be seen as concepts. And he was offering concepts for people to as he said, the regular experts in society didn't dare to pretend they knew what was going on. McLuhan pretended he knew what was going on. He did a good job at it. Everybody liked what he presented. So why did I say that?
Without understanding what he was saying, right? They liked his put on.
Right, right. They liked his put on. And let's see. So I'm saying McLuhan per step. I think I had a point there. Just that he says to the New York Times in 67, that young guy, Richard somebody, who did a lot of writings about avant-garde culture. Funny.
Costellanos.
Yeah, Costellanos. And McLuhan said it to him. And he's a young baby boomer guy who's into concepts. He's going to make a career out of it, you know, get grants and write books. And so McLuhan's statement to him was fitting for that young baby boomer, you know. It'd be a way a baby boomer would understand, oh, yeah, McLuhan's putting this on because we need concepts. It's a kind of therapy, collective therapy. Now
I see that as a statement of despair because
by me?
By him, by McLuhan, because what happens if you want to translate, as we were talking about you translating McLuhan, the whole point is to get the person to stop thinking in one way and to start thinking in another way. And the as long as the person thinks in concepts, that is to say, as long as the person thinks in terms of the old thinking, as long as the person thinks in terms of the old language and just translates word for word from he or she hears a word, let's say in French, and then they rack their brain and they come up with some sort of English translation, and then they go on to the next word. Well, that's exactly not to understand French. It's to understand English, a way of classifying French words in English. So what a translation is trying to do is trying to get a person to make a jump, and that jump can be called tactility, it can be called living the gap, it can be called a lot of things. But when McLuhan talks about supplying concepts, that's a kind of despair. It's a kind of saying, I've tried for 30 years to communicate, and every time I try to communicate, the person, instead of understanding the new language, understands the new words in the old language. And
I agree. Did you finish your sentence?
Well, I mean, I could have gone on, but I realized that I was getting away from your point, and so I wanted to hand the ball back to you.
Good, because I want to say this. For the record, I lived in New York for many years, and I met Costellanos, so we had an argument with the landlord or something, so he had to go to civil court, whatever they call it, and we walk in the evening, the room's quite filled, and there's a guy at a table at the front haranguing the judges or whatever they are, the judges, haranguing on about what a fair, unfair deal he was getting from Con Ed and all this stuff, and so I didn't know who he was. But then when he finished, he caused quite a scene. When he walked out, I recognized him, Costellanos. So I went up and I started talking to him. And we walked home once we finished our thing, which didn't take very long. And we walked home and had a nice talk. But I was laughing to myself, right? Here's this guy. He had a great career in cultural journalism in New York Times and many books and many grants. And he ended in 2000, when would this be? Yeah, 2005. Here's New York, collapsed place, and he's ranting on. This is what happened to a good mind. You know what I mean? He's a nobody in the larger structure of New York City, and he's pissed off, and he doesn't care what they think. He just insults them, and he didn't win. He lost his case, and whatever Con Ed was doing on him. But that's funny, eh? A guy, he didn't know what I knew about him. I eventually told him later a little bit about myself, but you know, it's like I don't know, being the. Because he was a good McLuhanite. He studied McLuhan a lot and would quote him, at least, you know, kept up on McLuhan. So it was like, I'm a stepbrother that he never met, and I'm not telling him. And I'm watching him from, because I know his whole history with his father, so to speak. So anyways, that's a little side story about what happened to Richard Castellanos. Don't know where he is today. So I'm saying no previous president of the USA has ever used the office of the White House to provide a training in perception. Now, there's a slight consciousness in Trump about how to play the game because nobody had the media savviness that he brought on himself by being a host of a TV show and a gossip guy in the New York Post. And he had a modern familiarity of media, especially in New York City, that the citizen had. The citizen is naive in the Ike era. Ike is naive, you know, in the 50s, it would seem. So there's a bit of consciousness and put on in Trump compared to other presidents. And it's required of that time because the American population is quite conscious, tech-savvy and sophisticated, sure. Unconsciously brought into those higher decibels of level of consciousness that McLuhan would say, but way more sophisticated than people were 50 years ago, you know, before.
Sure. Well, think of it pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Millions and millions of people are watching pro wrestling, and they're all caught up in it and all this sort of stuff. But they don't reflect on, and they don't reflect on, and they don't care about if what's going on is a real fight or if it's staged or what the hell it is. It's just a kind of they're spending their time enjoying themselves.
They don't mind illusion. They know it's
no,
fake.
Absolutely, exactly. And so then along comes somebody like Trump. That is an illusionist.
Yeah.
Right? That's what You're Fired is all about. It's kind of pro wrestling.
Yeah. And remember, there's footage of him fighting the head of the World Wide Wrestling, you know, that Canadian, he's a Canadian.
Yeah.
You know that guy.
Yeah? Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I can't remember.
Yeah, there's footage of they're on the ground beside the outside of the ring fighting. And I assume it was a put-on, but I'm not an expert aesthete of what was going on there, but they're scrawling on the ground, really going at it, right? You would never, no president, even Gary, whatever his name is, who never made it, no president would be ever caught doing that, right?
Absolutely.
I enjoyed Trump's bravado, even though it was crude for people. It was so.
When you say bravado, bravado, do you mean that you thought it was a conscious bravado?
No.
Put on.
Well, I liked. Okay. He had no. He was constantly did not give a damn about media. He didn't care what his image was, and you know it came out that he would call up reporters and pretend he was a friend of Trump and promote Trump as another person. But it was Trump, apparently. And he didn't care that the gossip people kind of knew it was Trump. I mean, his indifference is very good, very appropriate to our time.
Yeah, interesting. If you think of what we were saying earlier about bodies, you can see the multiple bodies of Reagan being somewhat conscious of each other and careful with each other.
Yeah.
And so what happens in the jump to Trump is that you have these multiple bodies, multiple roles, multiple images, and they no longer give a shit about each other.
That's right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and when we think about how the presidents and society need to kind of mirror each other, what you see is a society coming to consciousness of its multiple contradictory roles. Yeah, and saying, well, who gives a shit? That's the way it is.
Yeah, and it was shown on the talk shows, you know, the Jerry Springer shows of the 90s, where people idiotically displayed their crazy lives and didn't care what people thought.
Correct, correct.
It didn't seem to.
And all sorts of people were watching this and didn't care about what they were watching.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable, right? Just as an example, Bob, with Jerry Springer, the cardiologist that I go to has a large waiting room, and they force people to watch television. Why they do it, I don't know. Maybe it's like airports having a contract with CNN. So anyway, one day I'm there waiting for my appointment to see my cardiologist, and Jerry Springer is on. And there's prostitutes that are arguing about what they should do for what charge and all that stuff. And as always, they start to fight with each other, these prostitutes, right? And they're fighting, and their language is getting raunchier and raunchier and raunchier. And the people that were waiting to see their cardiologist, these are mostly elderly women. and you could see that the whole waiting room was getting further and further and further away from the television. And people began to more or less fight for seats at the back of the waiting room to get away from the television. The television was beaming out bullets or something that they couldn't take. It was one of the more amazing scenes of my life.
Yeah, no, I get that. There's a guy I knew in L.A. when I was living in New York, so this is like around 1999 or so, and he got people guests for these kind of shows. And so I got a call from this lady, and she wanted to have me on the show as an expert or something. So she asked me questions, and I gave a semi-McLuhan, good technical, interesting statements. You know, I assumed it was I should be sober and grace her with my wisdom, my McLuhan-esque wisdom. After the interview, I got a call from Tom half hour later. He said, "What the hell did you say to that lady? She was so pissed off. She thought that you were going to say that you tried to kill Reagan or some crazy fucking idea." And she was not. She said he was a typical bourgeois white guy with a stupid know-it-all bunch of shit. I don't know what he was talking about. It was horrible. And don't do that again. Tom almost lost his job because he recommended me. So was that pretty? That's pretty funny, eh? I don't hear you laughing.
It is funny.
Yeah.
Well, you were in. You put on your non-crazy mask.
Yeah.
And they didn't want that.
Yeah. So Tom was actually irresponsible in how he gave her the impression I was pretty wild, you know. Mm. And,
well, he may have given you the wrong impression of what they were looking for.
He didn't tell me.
You have an excellent capability of being wild.
Yeah, I could have. If they wanted me to be wild, I could have been, but I thought they were
easily,
one of them.
Easily. Yeah, yeah.
But I was interacting with your fucking doctor's office. That's what the problem was.
Yeah.
They were looking
That's
for
right.
somebody on your to be in your in that office on the screen.
Correct. On Jerry's fan. Yep.
And the other guy was Monty somebody, you know, another name. There was two of them. You remember that other name, Monty somebody? Not the black guy. But there was another white guy who had a pretty rowdy show. Okay, so
there was a guy called Monty Hall, but I don't I don't think that's what you're talking about.
Who knows? It's so many thousand years ago.
Let me just interrupt for half a second here.
Yeah.
July the 2nd, so 6 days ago, I sent you a letter about John Cage going to lunch with Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah.
And it came out of a book by Richard Castellanos.
Oh.
And so when we talked about Castellanos, it was kind of a reversion, an unconscious reversion in a circle back to that email. You probably didn't even notice that it involved Castellanos.
That's right.
It's interesting how life has those kind of echoes and reversals in time.
Well, in an information overloaded society, there's more potential for those kind of synchronicities to happen.
Oh. Yeah, they must happen. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I didn't notice anything because I don't like the way Cage talks about McLuhan. He's dull. It's silly almost.
Yeah, that's right. How can I say? It's a guy who's he's got a sort of fixed idea, and he doesn't really listen ideas that contradict it or that aren't parallel with it. You could say
that's right. He feigns. Okay, McLuhan once said to me that Bucky Fuller was a 19th century artist, and he and John Cage were 20th century artists. So that's interesting. He puts Cage up there close to him, but Cage acts, he's a totally unconscious 20th century artist, it seems. You know, he doesn't understand the effects he's working with or the conscious way McLuhan talked about his own art. Cage is nowhere near McLuhan on that level. And that quote shows it once again. I hadn't read that before, that one. And, you know, he was probably saying it to Castellanos, and there was a laziness, the two of them, who had made it in New York culture, so to speak, and they were talking about McLuhan lazily.
Right.
You know, Castellanos should have... go ahead.
This is not Cage talking to Castellanos. What Castellanos did was he went back to a whole bunch of obscure interviews that Cage had held. Some of them were with high school newspapers and with college yearbooks and stuff like that, things that nobody had ever seen. And he collected what you could call Cage's table talk or something from all these obscure sources. And what I did was I went through his table talk and had a look at what he had to say about McLuhan. Usually it was just mentioning him in passing.
Yeah.
But the one passage that I thought was interesting, I sent to you, and it simply was sort of a, as you were saying, it was a kind of affirmation on Cage's part that at the end of the day, he knew something that McLuhan didn't, but he was wrong about that.
That's right. Let's see.
Sorry, I got you off the book. We should go back to the two schools or approaches.
Right. No, I know where we are, but I was just thinking that I have another thought about Cage. He has very good quotes, useful as figures in the medium as a massage. There are good quotes that McLuhan could use, but naive people thought he was promoting John Cage. People didn't know that he was presenting effects. People are effects of the environment. Their art is popular because of the environment. And so basically
it's like a president representing society.
Yeah. And who was I just thinking of? McLuhan. You know that statement, art is anything you can get away with. I always thought that was said by someone else, not by McLuhan. But he's quoted as saying it, and if I'm right, they read it lazily. They just think McLuhan said it. But do you know where it came from? Did you ever see it?
No. I've seen the quote a million times.
No, but did you ever see where it came in an essay by McLuhan?
No.
Right. I've never seen it by McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people will, they'll quote McLuhan in the revivals. You know, McLuhan is a little more read now. They'll quote that as his statement on art. And it's far from what McLuhan was saying about art. It's lazy talk. And
well, what happens in the media environment is that something gets said. Maybe somebody writes an article and they say that McLuhan said this. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But then that article somehow gets into the ether and becomes very popular. And so that saying becomes sort of put in concrete.
Yep.
It's because this article has become so popular, therefore what's in the article is what really happened. And, of course, it has no relationship with reality whatsoever.
Right. But it's wrestling.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what's funny. I mean, I consider McLuhan the Einstein of the second half of the 20th century, and the fate of an intellectual is ridiculous in the second half of the 20th century. I mean, there's so much confusion about everybody, misquoted, you know, rumors, image, gossip, and McLuhan was lost, consciously, he knew, he understood that was happening, but he was Finneganized, Finnegan wake raped, like everybody else in his time. And that's what people don't see, the irony of a great thinker or perceiver or an original person that never got any insight to what he was talking about.
Correct. But I see that as having always happened.
Yeah,
I see that as happening already with Plato. And Plato was blessed because he did have a great student in Aristotle. Most great thinkers do not have any kind of following, and their thinking is basically never understood.
Right.
So at least Plato had Aristotle, but what you were just saying about McLuhan's fate is the fate of thinking. Thinking has been done throughout the tradition, but thinking has never been translated in a way that people understood. So it always has to start again and again and again.
Right. But I say that McLuhan represents, among ratios, super breakthrough arriving at something that people could use practically. Thinking finally became relevant to people.
Right, but that's because that's in your linear mode.
Yeah.
And I'm talking the...
You're not going linear. Okay, so the next sentence. In Western art, there are two schools or approaches to the creative act as spelled out by Marshall McLuhan. So this is from Interior Landscape, a collection of his essays, came out in 69. But this is a quote from, I should have given the era, but it's about Joyce. So it's 1953.
Uh-huh.
It's in one of the two McLuhan essays on Joyce in 53.
Yeah, 53 or 54, yeah.
Right. So McLuhan says, helping the reader to get a handle on Joyce, that in the non-part of this, he explains the history of the cathartic school, I think symbolized by people like Matthew Arnold, who were moralists and wouldn't go anywhere near popular culture. And McLuhan said the more relevant artists for the 20th century was the artists, because they were surrounded by pop culture, that dared to look at pop culture and bring it into their aesthetic theories or whatever. So, McLuhan, and I don't know if anybody ever said this before, these two types. Do you know any critic in the 19th century that was aware of these two schools? Did McLuhan make this up? What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I would be very surprised if he didn't take that from somebody or even from a movement.
Right.
For example, I really don't know much about Gertrude Levy, but it may be that she talks about stuff like this. I don't know. But one of the interesting things about McLuhan is that he read people like Levy when nobody else was. Nobody took her seriously.
Right.
Then maybe 15 or 20 years later, from reading McLuhan, Fry started to read Levy. And that, there's a lot of sort of interesting things like this that went on between McLuhan and Fry and McLuhan and the University of Toronto, where people, like in the early 50s, they were probably saying, oh, this guy's a jerk. He reads non-academic people like Levy, and he's interested in extreme forms of Catholicism or something. And then 15 years later, they're saying, oh, look at this interesting stuff in Levy.
Right. And they've been changed by the media, and they forgot that McLuhan said something about the person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that what that shows is that the despair that somebody like McLuhan had, because all of the percepts were automatically changed into concepts and translation became impossible, or dialectic became impossible. In his better moments, he knew, T.S. Eliot did, that communication does not take place in that way. Communication takes place in a different way that we don't understand. As you just said, there's a change in the media environment, and then understanding happens somehow.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
So the despair that we were talking about before is in a certain way misplaced. It's hard not to have it because the thinker feels that if only my thought could be rethought, then we'd be in a better place. But thinking almost never gets rethought. Instead, what happens is it gets lost, but in getting lost, it still has the possibility of being communicated.
No, all very good points you're making there. Okay, so McLuhan says, for that school of thought for which the external world is an opaque prison, art can never be regarded as a source of knowledge, but only as a moral discipline and a study of endurance. Now, he's describing what later he calls the cathartic school. And McLuhan is not of that bent. So then his next sentence, the artist is not a reader of radiant signatures on materia signata, and that's in quotes, but the signer of a forged check on our hopes and sympathies. This school has supported the idea of the function of art as catharsis, which, as G.R. Levy shows in The Gate of Horn, was a preparation for the lesser Greek mysteries.
Yeah. Let's just stop there for half a second. If we remember what we were saying earlier about Trump and pro wrestling and the president representing society and stuff, look at this phrase, the signer of a forged check on our hopes and sympathies. Right? That's exactly what we were saying before.
Yep. The artist is not a reader of radiant signatures on materia signata. That's the cognitive school, but the sign of a forged check on her hopes and sympathies, that's not the kind of a sentence that a Catholic would say, or maybe a sophisticated Catholic might know that, but the forged check on our hopes and sympathies are...
It's like Trump's TV show.
Yeah, but the...
It's exactly what it is.
Yes, but the thing is... Once you get into the 20th century, McLuhan said moral values, which were more prominent in the culture of the 19th century, just aren't going to make it for perceiving what's going on in the 20th century. So the humanist stress on values immorality and aesthetic superiority or snobbishness, elitism, is a forged check. It's a very dangerous situation on normal human hopes and sympathies. It's actually wrong to do cathartic art in the 20th century. And that's actually
it may be wrong in some moral sense. I don't think.
I would say it not maybe wrong, not perceptive. It's not helping what art is supposed to do in McLuhan's.
Correct, but on the other hand, nobody knows what art is supposed to do, and so the forged check is kind of inevitable.
Yeah,
right? The only way for McLuhan, at least, the only way not to have a forged check on our hopes and sympathies is to be a reader of radiant signatures on Materia Signata,
yeah,
which is how he saw Joyce.
Exactly. And I'm thinking that McLuhan he's commenting on the art establishment and their rearview mirrorism. He talks about that in Understanding Media. And it's always ironic to consider how Ted Carpenter went into that world, the Cultures Our Business art world. So he defected from McLuhan, I often would say. He defected from McLuhan's anti-environmental stance on art. He did write about it in a book in the late 60s, but he ended up living with the mafia that ran the art world. You know about that family, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But they participated in a world of bullshit, you could say.
Yeah.
But there were definitely levels of taste within that art world, and that family, you know, the Schlumberger family, I forget their French name, they had excellent taste, and some of the art that they promoted and preserved and purchased is very great art.
Right, right. And wasn't it something like DeMille?
Yeah.
DeMille.
Yeah.
DeMille.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, the DeMille family. Yeah. That was the Schlumberger daughter was married to a French culture vulture, DeMille, who did himself get investigated for being a suspect in the Kennedy assassination. Did I ever tell you that?
No.
Oh, yeah. No. He was part of the Dallas gang that was very suspicious around the oil executive, Clint Murchison. And in the Warren Commission, there's 26 volumes of it, which I used to have, he's called before the Warren Commission and interviewed by, you know, Alan Dulles and McCloy under suspicion.
Group to be the judges, right?
Yeah. So, and he only lived a few more years. He died in 73. But that's a pretty amazing thing that they make a famous art scene in Houston, Texas, when they first come from Europe, and they make the Mark Rothko Chapel. And,
that's right.
And they
that was one of the things I was thinking of their superior taste.
Yeah, they made the whole art world of the avant-garde, including Andy Warhol. They made it. They had a young guy working for him, and he went up to New York and became manager for Warhol, and then met everybody else. And so the whole 60s art explosion that McLuhan commented on was promoted by the DeMilles.
Yeah.
And Carpenter was married to one of the DeMille's daughters.
Correct.
So, let's see.
And these we should say that for people who don't know, these people were fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
Their holdings in Texas and in New York were incredible. I believe in the Hamptons, their property was, I don't know, 40 acres or 80 acres or something on the water.
Yep.
And it was one of the great estates in the Long Island scene.
That's right. I went out there and got to witness it. Now, they had an apartment at 222 Central Park South, right at the foot of Central Park and around 59th Street. And there was an incredible design on the front of the building, which I think was the two or three floors that she had, that Carpenter lived in when he was in New York City. And I just happened to see last week that I saw the title, the address, in some New York news. And they tore down this. It was a smaller building. They tore it down and made this huge high-rise. Now it's one of the most the second or most expensive art apartment building in New York.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a fabulous location.
Yeah, yeah.
No question about it. And isn't it right next door to the Columbus Art Museum?
Yeah, well, yes, that's just down the street. That goes into 50, that becomes 60th Street, I think. And the Trump Tower is right on that circle, too.
Yeah, at the other end. That's
yeah.
Right.
Okay, so the signer of a forged check on our hopes and sympathies. The other school did not deal with hopes and sympathies. It dealt
no.
with the present century mix, say. So,
well, the most important thing is when McLuhan uses a phrase like the signer of a forged check on our hopes and sympathies, he is making a reference for people that are reading his work to people that sign a check on reality. Right, that's the contrast that he has in mind here. So that if you're a reader of Radiant Signatures, really what you're doing is you're checking out reality. And for those that can't check out reality, they have to sign a forged check on hopes and sympathies, which are a kind of curtain hiding reality.
Yeah, it gets into value judgments and cultural alibis about the role of art and how valuable it is or something.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Call it the Mumico School of Art. When women ran art, they thought it was an image of higher things. Now remember, McLuhan said pop art meant that men took over art. Do you ever pick up on that?
No.
Yeah, he talks about it.
But
somewhere.
But if he were, using terms like that, he's not talking about people that have testicles and people who don't.
No,
he's talking of images.
Right, and the women ran culture in the 19th century. They were the teachers and schools and that, and that was. You would say that the women weren't as tough as the artists because women were not in resonance with the left hemisphere patriarchal literate world. They were right hemisphered. So they hoiked up right hemisphere values, whatever they are, but something that's not science and logic and math, so to speak. But as science became an art form and art became science, that's what McLuhan says in Take Today, then you get the technician comes into the art world, the male, so to speak, male abilities. And that's before women's lib, when women were allowed to go to engineering schools later. You know, Carolyn was in med school in the early 70s in Halifax, 74, and it was a big deal to have women in med school. That recently, you know, there was
absolutely,
and it really changed fast. Within a couple of years, there were equal number of women, young ladies, in the med school. But Carol was right on the transition border.
Mm-hmm.
So men take over the art world, and it also, and also in the 30s, in Laws of Media, Eric writes, and maybe Marshall wrote it too, that the artists of the 30s got bogged down in political ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the art in the 30s...
Well, McLuhan talks about that in his Dos Passos article.
McLuhan does?
Yeah.
In Dos Passos, yeah. Dos Passos is the political guy. Right. He's
yeah.
a leftist. And But I think McLuhan in that essay, he points out Dos Passos is part of a trend, but I don't see him being as blatant as Eric writes in Laws of Media that the whole art culture world got totally confused, even Pound and Lewis and everybody, right? They got lost in the effect of radio. I don't see McLuhan, he's not that sharp about it with Dos Passos. He just knows Dos Passos is missing out on the cognitive school and
mm-hmm.
too much in the value school of helping the working class or something.
Right, but he's also, McLuhan's also a more careful thinker and a more careful writer than Eric.
Than who?
So he, Eric. Weren't you
oh, yeah, yeah,
that?
Right. No, you're right.
Right, so... you know, he...
Well, people, knowledgeable people who knew McLuhan sort of relatively well, they said, that's a bad book. Eric botched it. They say, that's not McLuhan.
Right. Yeah, there are parts of Laws of Media that distort McLuhan fairly radically.
Yeah.
Because what Eric... wanted to do was to provide a kind of base for McLuhan, and he tries to do it in terms of epistemology or anthropology or something.
Yeah, what did you say? You wanted to provide a type of base?
No, base, B-A-S-E.
Oh, base. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, foundation. Yeah. Yeah. But is my speech so slurred?
No, just sometimes. It's just the phone. Not you know, it's good. Just that word I couldn't get.
Right, right.
Just that
so
word.
So anyway, when Eric tries to ground McLuhan in different ways in Laws of Media, he usually does it in terms of sources that McLuhan didn't read because they came out after he died. And are not very thoughtful sources to begin with.
Mm.
And then to use them to clarify or ground McLuhan, that's that wasn't a good move.
Right, and that's your specialty. You critique even someone like Eric, who many people would think knew a lot more about McLuhan than you did. And you
uh-huh.
make some interesting
and
points.
In many ways he did. In many ways he
yeah.
did, for sure. Yeah.
But you make some points that nobody else seems capable of making or even noticed.
Maybe.
We'll see, yes. We don't want to get too
yeah.
excited yet.
A lot of people, one of the ways in which thinkers are misunderstood, even by their own families, is that... thinkers are thought of as kings. And so then the next generation are the princes, and they in turn have to become kings. And so you have this phenomenon of the McLuhan family being asked to address various academic bodies more or less on behalf of Marshall. the insane idea
yeah.
is that these members of the McLuhan family have any idea about what Marshall was talking about.
Right, right, right. Okay, so this first school, the cathartic school, this school has supported the idea of the function of art as catharsis, which is the populist view of art. People say, wow, you know, art is an epiphany. You know, what would they say, you know, at the art schools and that? Very traumatic, whatever they were learning, and then they made an art painting about it or something, and it's all emotional.
Carthus would be explicated as living through.
All the neurotic cliches about the artist in the garret, the alienated guy who's who just can't, he's too sensitive for the industrial age.
Correct.
So this school has supported the idea of the function of artist catharsis, which, as G.R. Levy shows in The Gate of Horn, was a preparation for the lesser Greek mysteries, which is Gnosticism?
Greek mysteries? No, the lesser Greek mysteries are the preparatory mysteries prior to Eleusis.
Prior to what?
Eleusis.
What's Alexis?
Eleusis. Eleusis. Eleusis.
Oh, Eleusis. Eleusis.
So I was pronouncing it in modern Greek, and you're taking it back to ancient Greek. Yeah.
Okay. But isn't that paganism, which tended to be Gnostic?
Well, in McLuhan's terms, I guess I would agree. It's just that Gnosticism can be understood as a style of thought, which anybody could have, or it can be understood as various sects that grew up, you know, in the 500 years around
around the time of the phonetic alphabet.
A little bit later, and going from, let's say, from 300 BC to 300 AD.
Yeah,
that kind of time frame. So. If you're saying esoteric or Gnostic in the small g sense, then I would agree.
Right. Okay, so the cathartic school might be paganism. But if the world is not opaque, if it's opaque, an opaque prison, you get emotional about that. But if the world is not opaque, and if the mind is not of the earth earthy, then this moral view of art should yield to the cognitive view. However that may be, the cathartic ethical view of art has led to a doctrinaire hostility to the use of discontinuity in art, and that's the theme of Matthew Arnold's preface to Poems, a book he put out called Poems in 1853. And note, this is in 1853 when this article is being 1953, so it's the 100th anniversary of that date. However that may be, the cathartic ethical view of art has led to a doctrinaire hostility to the use of discontinuity in art, the theme of Arnold's preface to Poems, 1853, and indifference, so hostility to the use of discontinuity, and this hostility also is indifferent to all popular art. And in the past century, with every technological device advancing the discontinuous character of communication, that's a good statement, the stand taken by the cathartic and ethical school has enveloped the entire world of popular culture in a haze of esoteric innescence, disguised, however, as a profound moral concern with the wider hope. There's the hope and sympathies, the wider hope and the higher things. Joyce had a phrase for this anti-cognitive attitude, the cultic twilight, based on the Celtic twilight, a phenomenon in Dublin that Yeats was part of. The retrieval of, I don't know, the Irish folklore before the Europe showed up.
And the emphasis there being on toilet.
Yes, toilet, the toilet. So I'm saying, so then what I do is I feature a video excerpt of Zbigniew Brzezinski's daughter, and Joe Scarborough, the morning talk show people, discussed at Trump's morals and everything. And I say this is an example of the cathartic view of art applied to the art of the White House and how feeble it is in dealing with Trump. And Trump outdoes these people all the time. You know, he doesn't get subject to the wider hope and the higher things. So you need to use the cognitive style to look at Trump.
Right.
Can't use a cathartic or the look at, don't look at Trump as ethics, a problem in ethics or whatever, which the courts are always trying to do during his administration.
Right.
Always trying to catch him on some businessman corruption, you know.
Right, and which is always a signer of a forged check.
Yeah.
Because this supposed morality has no base. It's not anything that they can hand over to their own children. Right, it's not even something that they believe themselves.
That's right.
I think they were both married, and then they were had an affair and got divorced and got married themselves. Or I don't even know what exactly happened there. I don't even want to know. But
right.
I just know that this view of morality is bullshit, even in terms of them.
Yeah.
Right? Put it another way, especially in terms of them.
Right.
So these people on, what's it called, Today or something like that?
The View. The View.
No, they're not on The View.
Oh, Good Morning,
morning.
Good Morning America Today kind of shows, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they themselves are like a president. They put on their audience, and it's only because of this relationship with the audience that they're successful. If they're not able to put on the audience, then they can't get elected. They can't get the job.
Yeah. And,
right.
And journalism is all about the wider hopes and ethical values and morality.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so Trump killed, quote, the media, the moralistic journalists, the Wolf Blitzers and Mike Wallace's or whatever of the world, of the New York media circus. He bypassed with his shamanic hoiking up of the cognitive approach.
Right.
Somebody quoted me something Trump said today. And again, it was simple, oddly said, but so right on and honest. Sort of quote honest, I guess, but he had that ability to address people probably around values, retrieving the old America, but he always did it as a perceptual thing, which probably got more perceptual because of his awkward way of speaking or his non-literate way of speaking, right? So he really was a walking percept.
When you are talking about was.
About what?
You're saying.
You're gone away. Saying, come back in. You're too far away in your phone.
I'm sorry. I was trying to exercise my arm, which was going to sleep. what I was questioning is your use of the past tense. When you say he was doing this and that, do you mean to be using the past tense or do you mean to be using the present tense?
Mm. He's doing it today, still doing
that's
it.
That's what I mean, yeah. So,
I mean the present and the past and the future, all
right,
now.
Right, yeah.
He's a walking percept.
When you come to the cognitive view, do you believe that he actually knows anything about the cognitive view?
No.
Or do you believe that it kind of speaks through him?
It's almost like you have to be the cognitive view today, because how can anybody have an opinion about the chaos of the globe of the past 10 years? How do you project values? You have to exude a kind of, what is that? quote that McLuhan used to get. He got it from Reagan. I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to be perceptually the almost the Wild West sheriff, which might be too old, but that was America, and he used that image in the Bonanza talk of the 60s. But he has to show a confidence, not based on ideas, but by being, quote, tough. And McLuhan said, as the world got more and more Paleolithic, neo-Paleolithic, toughness was going to permeate all of society.
Yeah, and that goes to what we've talked about in the past about going out to be alone, right? If no role has a foundation, and if you have to have a role, if you have to put on a role, then the only way to maintain it is by being tough.
Yep.
It's by being going out to be alone.
And
you don't give a shit about what anybody thinks
niceties.
About your role. You got to do it, right?
Yeah. And that on the working class, lower class, the uneducated class, the tactile class, whatever you call the masses, they reported more and more over the last 40 years a disgust with the lack of toughness in the president. They, as tribal people, wanted that. And they finally got it with Trump, the kind of toughness that was extreme, but it was so late in the game, they wanted an extreme image. Or he made them want it, because when he did it, it reminded them, that's what we want. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because the world was
I think
becoming.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. I'm not so sure that is the answer that the world needs.
No.
But it's putting on the audience. It's putting on the market,
mood.
For sure.
Yeah, and certainly the world doesn't need that. They need the comprehensive awareness McLuhan had. You know, they need to recognize the, you know, actually McLuhan retrieves the old Shelley or Keats line, the poets are the legislators of the world. McLuhan actually did that. He took poetic knowledge, the cognitive school, made it relevant, and became a very influential, quote, legislator of people's updating what was a way to talk about the present. That's never been said before.
Well,
he completed Keats and Shelley, whoever said it.
Yeah, you know, that's a kind of linear view. I would say that the philosophical king is always an interesting project, but never comes to fruition.
Well, he pointed out that you could not be a philosopher king in our time. He said that. He said philosopher king is completely obsolete and not relevant. And so he talked about the trend to government by committee, but McLuhan would make a smarter committee than the present intelligence agency committee that does what I call tetrad management.
Correct. But I'm just trying to point out that the line between the philosopher king and the committee is vague, hard to draw. Most people who draw it can only do it by being tough. It's Aristotle was very prescient when he said that all of the six possible forms of government transmute into each other periodically, and sort of the law of government is that there is no fixed form.
Right. And McLuhan developed, now this is where the legislator of the world, this is the poet coming up with laws of science, the new
That's
science.
Right.
And
but,
and understanding why something isn't fixed.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with that. So what you're saying there is that the only fix to politics is not in politics.
Right.
The only fix to social order is not in social order.
And you know, in the 60s, the artist, what are those guys' names? Roy Lichtenstein, name an older Claude Olderidge or something. Who was the guy made the hamburger?
Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Sort of pop art type guy.
Yeah, those guys got involved in an art and technology movement in the mid '60s. It was called EAT, E dot A dot T dot. Don Thiel met the artists involved with that, and they were
a great
picking,
acronym.
Right, EAT, and they were picking up the legislative media comprehensivists, media ecologists. That's how they translated McLuhan. They were reading McLuhan and getting, oh, we're artists, but we've got to get a little more technical or scientific or deal with technology and offer our refined sensibilities. And Lewis began that in 1919 in his book, The Caliph's Design. But here they are in the 60s retrieving that and under the influence of McLuhan trying to bring in artistic sensibilities to the management of society's problems, because the left hemisphere political strategies weren't working anymore. And he says in this great line in the foreword to the Interior Landscape Collection, which is where this quote I'm reading comes from, he says, must we continue to mow down the Kennedys to show that the hot politics, that hot politics doesn't work on the cool medium of TV?
Right.
A great line. Now,
sure.
He relates
centrally to being tough.
That's right. And Nelson and I used to get on the radio and say that McLuhan admitted he was involved in the Kennedy assassination. Yeah, he says, must we continue to bow down? But that would be the tribal we, the collective guilty we of the imploded resonant node that made HCE, Here Comes Everybody. To wax a little eloquent there for your
ears. Always has come, as you could say.
There's your non-linear self.
That's right. That's right. But I'm thinking of Brutus killing Julius Caesar, for example.
Yeah. Okay, so, all right, back to this thing. So my put-on is taking a very high culture pattern from McLuhan and applying it to Trump and daring anybody to say that's not the dirty world of politics, come on. But actually, it does fit, because Trump did move in past nostrums and value judgments and of the journalistic political world. He became pure percept, a tough walking percept. And the journalists, I remember some of the New York Times, there was interviews with them after a year or so of Trump, and they said, we can't keep up with the guy. The guy just says one lie after another. But see, they didn't understand the wrestling hallucination going on, and lying was not the issue. He was there to provide stability. I mean, McLuhan, Ted Carpenter got mad at McLuhan for hanging out with Hubert Humphrey and LBJ, you know, being seen in the same photo with them. But McLuhan had the toughness to say, bless LBJ for, you know, stabilizing the ship of state, because McLuhan knew how reckless the whole scene was. And in his private letters to Mary McLuhan, which I have, to his daughter, where she's considering a divorce in 73, he's saying this world is so screwed up, he didn't use that word, but he meant that nuclear war can go off any second. He understood
Correct.
The panic that was going on all over the place, because nobody could really get this new environmental probing of everything, by everything, and of everything. So,
But he also understood how dangerous that panic
that's
was.
What I'm saying, yeah, the danger of it. So, okay, so I was saying that McLuhan understood the violence of the time. It's way more violent by Trump's time. I wanted to add this. So there was this guy somewheres who wrote an essay on Trump probably read the Playboy interview in March 69, and he'd be in his early 20s, I think, and he was influenced by the quotes. And so the guy wrote all these different aspects of McLuhan's style or image and showed how Trump replayed McLuhan.
Right. So, I think that's one of the essays that you link at the very end.
Oh, good. I provide that. Right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
But, Bob, let me just interrupt for a second. There were a couple beeps on the phone just now.
Uh-oh.
I don't know if that was some problem with the recording. Can
Hello.
You still hear an echo?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, it's still working.
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me on the echo?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Okay, no, do your thing again.
Hello?
Yep, we can hear.
Okay, good. So
the noise beeps might be Carol in the kitchen in the background.
Oh, maybe. Okay. We should just go for another 15 minutes, if
okay.
that's okay with you.
No, that's good, because we did start late. So,
uh-huh.
Okay, so we're explaining. So Trump, the journalistic, the Gutenberg values, which hoik up the efficient causality and the Qatari School of Art. That has the advantage in the 18th and 19th century. Because
still
that's
going
the effective
strong.
Print. What?
But still going strong.
Yes, because that's what we are. The West, everybody became religious about and fanatic about their cultural bias in the global
Correct.
Theater. Everybody has to be tough with their retrieving their values.
That's
for
right.
tourism.
That's going out to be alone.
Yes. And so it's happening, we call it the tourist world, but it's not the way people live. They don't live those values, and that's the problem in education. You can't get those values across to the kids. It's not the way you can't teach them. You got to tell them how they got mutated and how they are in the world of the tech body, and give them a little detachment about the present. And you can't use traditional Western values to create that perception. You got to update the cognitive approach just to be a school teacher. And that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what McLuhan was doing. And that's why he's saying that discontinuity in electric environments through the whole 20th century was mimed by the different art movements.
Right.
With more and more...
And mimed in everybody's brain.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's the attempt to be a moral authority, even about one's own acts, never works.
Well, it didn't. It worked in the 19th and 18th century, not for the society, but it worked to give yourself a high profile like a Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah, but there's a difference between different kinds of working, right?
Yeah.
If you want to be a great moral authority on everything that's ever happened in the history of the world, then you can probably become a star on CNN.
Yes.
Or, I'm not saying it doesn't work in that sense. I'm saying that it doesn't work in the sense that it automatically betrays itself as soon as the moral judgment is announced.
Yeah.
It comes across as fake. It comes across as just bullshit.
Yeah.
And that's why we have these problems in education that you were just talking about.
Exactly. And, Trump is coming back strong. It's like you can't stop the Trump relevance of his image with whatever democratic values the Democrats are claiming to develop from book values. They're trying to bring back a decent bookish environment, a calm president who's remembering the higher hopes and sympathies.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And Trump is a little bit like the person who has the role of the jester
yeah.
On stage, and he makes asides like what bullshit this is or what bullshit that is, right? And,
yes.
of course, he's right.
Yeah.
Right? It's in my view, at least, what's happening to politics in the United States is extremely funny but extremely dangerous at the same time.
Oh, yeah. And you remind me, McLuhan talked about Trudeau as the first emperor come clown.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
he talks about that in Take Today.
Yeah, you can't be a real emperor of anything unless you have a very good sense of your own clownishness.
Right. Now, so that worked for Trudeau, but McLuhan said back in late 60s that Trudeau would not be possible in the United States because the United States was in the hot seat, had to deal with the problems, was the policeman. And the crises were directly affecting the American image. So you got a more and more serious presidential effect with Nixon, I guess, and then Carter, Gerry Ford not so much, and then Reagan. Reagan is all about making America great again.
As we said before, Reagan's all about making great America great again in a Trump-like fashion, but two of them have many bodies, many masks, and I don't think it's right to draw a straight line,
no.
say, from Nixon to Carter and then go on to Reagan and Clinton and Obama. All of these people suddenly are people on stage that have about 20 masks on a table beside them, and they're experts in whipping off one mask and putting on another.
Yeah, now that's what I call quadrophenia, which I'm going to develop later. And quadrophenia refers to the tetrad. You enhance a mask, you obsolesce it quickly, you retrieve another one, and then you flip into its opposite. That process citizens are doing all the time.
Correct.
And especially juggling their bodies. So that's what quadrophenia means to me. And somebody sent me a movie from 2018, and it was like an eccentric comedy or something, but the character's walking along a scene like a beach, Coney Island, and he's walking up to ice cream truck, and he goes, "This is quadrophenia." He uses my word. So I'll have to research who are these people who used it.
Yeah, got to get a clip and put it up on, give it to Ed.
Well, she sent me a clip, and I've got to extract it. So I'm explaining how McLuhan's sophisticated McLuhan cognitive view is the way to look at Trump. So that's my
Correct.
Opening revolutionary unique approach to Trump in 2017.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting myself.
Yeah.
The types of people that were cognitive for McLuhan were like Pound and Joyce. You're saying here is that in order to understand what's going on with Trump, you have to, number one, take distance, and then you have to understand the reality of the situation. You can't put on a moral mask and reflect on how what you see is in terms of that mask. The mask has to be taken off and a direct relationship with reality taken up.
Yeah, with the proviso that he said the objectivist stands naked before the world. The subjectivist puts on the world. You ever see those statements in the early 70s?
Yes. And you see, what's interesting about that is that if somebody like myself comes along and says, here's McLuhan saying, have a direct relationship to the world, it's as if he did not talk about media, right? But for McLuhan, unalterable fact that everything we perceive is mediated does not mean that we can't have a direct relationship with reality.
Yeah, right.
And that's exactly what is not understood. How can something that's mediated be direct?
Yes.
No, and so nobody understands that, and that's been the great thought from Plato to the present.
Very good, accurate and correct. And what would I add to that? The idea that media and nature merge is another version of what you're talking about being direct. And then McLuhan says all languages, all media are pseudo events. So you can't have a direct view if you're unaware of the media bias in the situation. You have to be aware of the media bias to have a direct view.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So we should sort of end around here, but let me say that this is sort of what McLuhan was doing around 1950. Innes had stressed the problem of solipsism. Innes said that the great problem in looking at the different civilizations is that you can never get out of your own. And that sort of solipsism means that not only can you not understand other cultures, you can never understand your own, because your own is an example of culture, and yet all you can understand is one of them. You can never understand the class.
So, the what? The class? C-L-A-S-S?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Innes was saying, on the one hand, in order to understand culture, you have to understand culture in general, all cultures. But everybody's locked into their own, and they can never understand others properly. Therefore, we're left with a problem of solipsism, and although Innes didn't read much, if anything, of Nietzsche, he came to a similar conclusion to Nietzsche, and that is that the great problem that the modern world has to deal with is solipsism come nihilism. So McLuhan, in the late 1940s, was through reading Innes, talking with Innes, trying to understand what was going on with Innes in relationship to his own Catholicism. McLuhan was left with the problem of how do we get out of solipsism? And so his work from the late 1940s until sort of the middle 1950s is very much concerned with how do we perceive existence aside from writing a forged check on it?
Yes.
And it's for anybody that wants to actually exercise the brain, actually think, then reading McLuhan, say, starting in 1949 with his Eliot essay on decorum and coming up to 1955 with his review of Kenner's book on Lewis, that six-year period is one where McLuhan is trying to work out that very, very difficult problem.
That's right, and it gets more complex after his surgery, going into the 70s. Did he add something to that 49 to 55 period?
I think in
the 70s.
I'm sorry, did you want me to answer that question,
yeah,
or were you going to go on?
Go ahead.
Well, I think the answer to that is that he did find interesting new ways to think about it, but he was never able to translate it, right? We started off our conversation today talking about the difficulty of translation and how it's always the fate of a thinker not to be able to translate his or her thought forward. And that's what happened to McLuhan. He understood by 1958 that the answer to his problems from 49 to 55 was the medium is the message. So if you sort out what media are, then you can sort out how it is that lack of immediacy, that is to say, how mediation can be direct. So that was, he came up with what he thought was the answer, but he couldn't hand it on. So then in the 60s and 70s, what he did, he found all sorts of interesting ways to think about this. For example, in terms of hijacking.
Yes.
Or in terms of comedy. All sorts of really interesting things to sort of follow up. But he didn't solve the problem of translation, and no one ever has.
Right, and just as many people would consider Finnegan's Wake a failure, he used that as a model in many ways, and he repeated its failure. And then you're saying nobody was a success.
Correct.
Would we have a success if the world was improved somehow greatly? Is that proof of...
Who knows? Who knows? But we have to come back to what we were saying earlier about despair. No thinker is able to translate, and yet communication is possible. That's the amazing thing. It's a little bit like the problem of mediation and being direct, that thinker is not able to translate his or her thought, and yet it is possible to communicate.
Yeah.
And we see, just for example, in the history of science, we can see that. People go along for thousands and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years by doing chemistry when they cook or when they cure leather or doing all sorts of things. When they digest their own food or breathe, they're doing tremendous chemistry, but they don't know what they're doing. And then suddenly... people figure out what's going on with chemistry. Well, that's kind of like the problem with thinking. If human beings are going to survive, they're going to have to figure out what's going on with their own thinking, or they're going to think themselves to death. That's the alternative.
Yeah. Thought, think, thought, thinking.
Yeah,
that's my four-line, my four-word response.
Yeah, there you go, which is more or less Aristotle.
Yes, I went Aristotelian in response to your Platonism.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Which McLuhan said, you can either be a Platonist or a Aristotelian, and that would be in the Western world, the Gutenberg world.
Yeah, that was his. He used that quotation from Coleridge in his master's thesis,
right,
at the University of Manitoba.
Right.
But McLuhan always knew that there weren't two temperaments of human beings. There were at least three.
Does he spell them out?
Oh, well, I mean, that's what his PhD thesis is all about, right? The trivium.
Oh, okay, yeah. But you were citing his master's thesis at Manitoba, weren't
right.
you?
Correct. Well, I was saying, you mentioned Coleridge's... citation in what is it called? Literaria biographia.
Yeah, biographia.
Yeah, so that's where he talks about everybody's born a Platonist or an Aristotelian. And then McLuhan quotes that in his master's thesis. But even in his master's thesis, he was well aware of there being three forms of temperament. Which he got from his teacher, Rupert Lodge, at Manitoba. So McLuhan always had the idea of what might be called applying Lodge outside of philosophy to literature and other disciplines. And that's what he did in his PhD thesis 10 years later.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, now, did Rupert Lodge present those three modalities as the trivium?
No.
Right.
No.
He may not have been aware of the trivium, but it was an influence in his organization from earlier education?
Could be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the sources of Lodge's work. That'd be an interesting question to look into at some point. Lodge was an Englishman, trained. I believe he was at Oxford for a while and at Manchester. But I really don't know the people he was reading. That's a very interesting question.
Right. So, I don't know what I was going to say about Rupert Lodge. Let's see. What's the other guy? What are the two names that influenced him at Manitoba?
Henry Wilkes Wright was the other guy. They were the co-heads of the philosophy department. I don't even know if there were other people in the philosophy department, but the two of them, up until the middle 30s, were the co-heads of the philosophy department. And then in the middle 30s, sometime around 35, the university hived off psychology from philosophy. Previously, they had been the same department. And
right.
So when they were separated, then Wright became the head of the psychology department, and Lodge remained the head of the philosophy department.
Right. So McLuhan took engineering the first year.
Right.
Then he went into English. But what's not said is that the big influences in Manitoba were in philosophy.
Correct. Not only for McLuhan, but Lodge especially was a very, very popular teacher and influenced a lot of folks.
Okay, so let's leave it at that. That was very good.
Okay.
And
let me just say that personally, I learned some interesting stuff today. I've read your book a couple times, and I really, even though I can see that it's right here in black and white, what we're talking about today, I did not understand before the particular angle that you were taking on Trump from a cognitive view.
Awesome.
And I think that's a very interesting thought, and I look forward to taking up further next time.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And you're smart for getting it. It is an act of genius what I came up with there.
Well, that's a good mask to put on for a while.
Yes. Okay. Thanks a lot, Cameron. Talk to you next week.
Okay, Bob. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.